Good evening, everyone. Just before we start, I'm just wondering, having gone through all the evidence we received evidence from our purposes of trust and the ministry certification, the statute table. We don't have the listener to be there.
No, yet, the table.
Right.
Yeah.
So the first submitter, who is Otago Game, Mr. Wilson. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I live with my family at the property located at 509 Seagrass Flat Road and have lived in the Wakatipu Basin for the last 20 years. Through my work as a professional engineer, I have been involved with and have had significant exposure to numerous local development projects. Over time, and through the course of this work, I have developed an academic interest in the land use patterns which have evolved in the Wakatipu Basin as a whole. My submissions. I've made an original submission and a further submission regarding Chapter 21 of the proposed fishery plan for PDP Rural. My evidence today should be read in conjunction with my original submission, number 675, and my further submission, number 1086. My brief evidence today principally disagrees with the submission from the Eden Farm Statement of Eden, and in my part, the pre-lodge evidence of Eden 86. Eden submit and request the following. That growth must be accommodated in all sectors. That growth will inevitably affect landscape values. That the PDP overemphasises the importance of farming activities. That other activities that require rural location, such as rural living and visitor activities, should also be enabled and should be on at least an equal footing with farming. Based on the above, submission 430 goes on to suggest alterations to the provision of the rural zone, Chapter 21 of the PDP. Suggested operations generally seek to serve other activities that require a rural location, the same status as farming. The difficulty with this suggestion is that the effects of farming activities in terms of landscape, nature conservation, soil, water and amenity are generally known, predictable and appropriate in terms of the rural resources and landscapes of the district. That is why farming activities have always been permitted activities. However, other activities that require a rural location are not well defined and are therefore much less predictable. For example, activities that require a rural location include such things as rural restaurants, paintball, bungee and zorkball operations, wedding reception venues, motor racing activities and wind farms. These things cannot be built in urban areas. They require a rural location, but clearly they should not be enabled in the same way or to the same degree that farming is. Are much more likely to adversely affect landscape character and visual amenity. I accept that the district plan should not merely prescribe farming and nothing else for the rural zone. However, it is very important to recognise that the form of landscape character that the rural land of the district display has come about through traditional rural land uses. This form of landscape character is obviously a very important resource for our district, underpinning the desirability of our district as a tourist destination and a living location. Additionally, I accept that traditional rural activities other than farming, such as forestry, mining, viticulture, rural recreation activities, training, hunting, fishing, etc., should be provided for similarly to farming. However, I consider that it would be a very significant change for this district and one that considerably altered much of its landscape character, if any activity that requires a rural location is enabled in the rural zone in the same way that farming traditionally has been. I also present the hypothesis that placing other activities that require a rural location on the same footing as farming activities neglects the benefits provided by farming and rural activities to other living areas in terms of diversity and differentiation of living environments, and in doing so, risks inappropriate development and loss of character. I've identified that farming activities provide benefits to other living areas and also landscape benefits by clearly differentiating the living environments from the other living areas. Consequently, it makes sense that farming activity needs to be prioritised in some way because of the inverse benefits it provides through this differentiation of living environments and character. Currently, this prioritisation is achieved by making farming and farming activities in rural areas permitted and other activities controlled and discretionary or non-compliant. The status quo in the planning is therefore an efficient way of reinforcing and providing for farming activities in the rural zone so that the open space benefits which are afforded to those settlements or living areas is acknowledged in some way and encouraged. Short of offering monetary subsidies to rural or farming landowners, this is presently the only tool available to recognise the benefits afforded to the other living areas by farming activities. Recognising this view, I've recently spent a significant period of time in Switzerland, where I observed the prevailing land use patterns. Switzerland is a country where the settlement pattern is dictated to by geographic and landscape constraints. It is obvious that the principle of maintaining and protecting open space between settlements, often with deer, grass pasture and rural grazing areas, has been prioritised to help reinforce, differentiate and support the type of dense living that is desired and which occurs in the settlement themselves. At a micro scale, the geographic and landscape constraints in the district are not dissimilar, and there are some parallels which can be drawn with the land use management approach which I observed in Switzerland. For example, it is very clear that the urbanised living style of the settlements are reinforced by their open space surroundings and open space activities. The joining of these settlements through removal of open space separation potentially destabilises the success of the urbanised living areas themselves. I submit that this is an aspect worthy of consideration in the EU context. Turning my hypothesis around the other way, I think the counterfactual is determined favoured by those in the finance industry. If there is no differentiation of rural land and farming activities, as is promoted by UN, then the benefits of open space in an urban design sense are lost. Also lost are the social benefits of the rural farming and open space areas reinforcing the living differences and therefore diversity of other living styles or zones. Consequently, if we proceed as promoted by urban and their experts, there is a high risk that everything will become very vanilla in a living sense, and this is separate to any landscape arguments. This will have a flow-on effect to the identity of the existing living area, and indeed what might be described as a cumulative character across the district. This is particularly relevant to how visitors might perceive the character of the district as a whole, and how this might change with time under the Refeaburn regime. Taking the counterfactual case further, if the other activities that require rural location are developed throughout the district on what was once rural land, then the rural character that these activities desire will soon be diminished to a level that provides no value and no utility to the desired activity. For example, in paragraph 2 of this tree lodge evidence, Mr. Baxter refers to the views from Seagrass Flat Road as follows, and I'll read. To drive along Seagrass Flat Road, by way of example, take the viewer along open pastoral view to each development and point towards dwelling setback from the road. The beautiful, existing patterns of the rural landscape in the Waterloo Basin. They are not a detrimental component of the rural landscape. They are an expected and valued part of that landscape. I have presumed that Mr. Baxter referred to the eastern end of Seagrass Flat Road between Glasshow Road and Lake Hayes Harrington Road. The views are limited at the east, sorry, the western end by mature hawthorn hedges and hedges tree planting. The majority of the land in the views which Mr. Baxter refers to is zoned rural, thus providing a balance of open vistas to the hedges and trees that surround some houses in the rural living areas that are partly visible. The view would be very different and significantly less valued if commercial recreation activities were located within the open paddock. Similarly, residential developments throughout the majority of the rural land cited by Mr. Baxter would also change these views, as over time the rural character would be more and more diluted from both inside and outside developments. Once land is subdivided, the use will change permanently and the rural character that still exists now is lost. I note that the benefits claimed in Mr. Stalker's pre-lodged evidence for evidence of subdivision allowing the maintenance of more elevated outstanding natural landscape are short term only, as the financial benefit of subdivision occurred only once and is not ongoing for future generations. I note that residential development, particularly greenfields and development of the urban density, must be located in a balanced manner that efficiently manages infrastructure, transport, education, protection of natural values, including ecology and landscape values, and including the protection of rural amenity. Dr. Marion Reid, in her report, Waka-Tipi Basin Residential Subdivision Development, Landscape Character Assessment 2014, recommended areas within the Waka-Tipi Basin that could absorb further residential development and be zoned rural lifestyle. If this recommendation is followed, PDP will already be affording opportunities for further rural living development in the Waka-Tipi Basin without the potentially uncontrolled and permitted consumption of rural land by other activities that require rural location or for accommodation of growth in all sectors, as is proposed and promoted by the urban and its experts. In closing, I believe that the PDP is proposed in the report of Dr. Reid reflects and mitigates the effects of the hypothesis that I have presented, and that the PDP as drafted should be adopted in preference to the proposals we submitted for you. Thank
you. So I can confirm where you are in your plan that's zoned currently under the proposed plan? Where the site
is? Currently where I reside, and I use the properties that I have responsibility for as trustee, are located in the rural residential zone, North Lake Hayes, I think it's classified.
Thank you for that. Just turning to your
evidence in paragraph 13 where he refers to the comments or the complaints of Mr. Baxter's in terms of the views that you're describing in your area, is there a component at all of openness in those views that contributes to the sort of amenity and that you've described as you've said wish to maintain?
Citing Mr. Baxter's evidence where he talks about the example, takes the viewer along open pastoral views in his development. So I'm exploring there that Mr. Baxter himself is identifying the open space that is in these areas. So there's currently his own rural, the open views he's identifying are on flatlands, along seagrass flat road, and that is a significant area of flat pastoral land, has been for some time, and I'm exploring the case that if the contention as put forward by Submitter 4B, that many activities are on the same footing as farming, that space is a permitted activity, that those lands obviously will not be the same as he values them.
Would you agree with Mr. Baxter's description as he's put it here from you?
Yes, with the writer that it was more accurately defined as the eastern end of Seagrass Flat Road.
Turning to paragraph 15, last sentence there, we talk about Dr. Reddy's recommendations on the outgrowth areas that could afford absorb further development. So by the next sentence here, is it you agree with what Dr. Reddy put forward?
Yes.
Support that.
Yes, I do agree with Dr. Reed's recommendations and the report to support what's proposed there. What I'm trying to illustrate here is if we go down the line of Evan, what Evan's proposing, we could potentially end up with an uncontrolled, and I've used the word permitted, consumption of rural land, which is a concern.
That's great, thank you very much.
In your original submission, you mentioned the FHA process that was undertaken to benefit the Royal Commission of Committee. Just review what happened there and what that process was. Is there much to know?
Quite a story to hear, Commissioner. As I recall, there's land owned by Evan, but an FHA application was made by a different entity. I think it was called Evan Development Limited for FHA. Commercial housing area. Okay. Originally, it was proposed that there was. I haven't got the facts in front of me, so I didn't bring my previous submission. Roughly about 150 allotments on land, that I identified on the planning map. I guess you'd describe it northeast of where I reside, on this rural zone of land. I've tried Mill Stream. I could identify it on map 26 commissions if they were here.
Thank you.
file on your map.
I'll continue.
And there was a discussion from the community about that area and some of the concerns. There was. So it was quite a significant land development proposal on land zone rule. There are a number of concerns raised out of the community about the proposal for 150 lots with very apparently limited controls. It was originally put forward on the basis of the Times Driver being that it was for affordable development. There were initially no affordable components of the proposal. Later at a council hearing, it was a late submission that even if developers would provide, I think, 10 houses within a radius of 10 kilometres of the site, so not actually on the site itself. It created a lot of opposition locally out of the community and residents, not just nearby residents, but out of the Arrowtown community. It was natural extension of the Arrowtown even growth boundary, quite a stretch in many people's views. The council rejected these VSA proposals. The sequence of events then followed that earlier this year. Another proposal was put forward on the same site. Another VSA proposal was put forward for Retirement Village. And that wound up the density to around 190 or 200 units, we'll call them. And it was really just a resubmission of the original residential plans, for example. There wasn't a great deal of updating in the plans. There was conflict of the evidence of the planners involved. Mr. Edmonds was involved. He wasn't sure of the number of units. Mr. Baxter was also involved. He wasn't sure of the number of units. They were both citing different numbers in that case. The tip was usually rushed. Also came to light at that time that even developments had decided that it was a good idea to officially review the council and their original decision to not recommend their original residential proposal to the Minister for Resident SHA. That was very disappointing to hear. I guess the quote out of that story is that the council rejected the retirement village proposal as well. Didn't actually include anything that was substantiated as a retirement proposal from the MQs, so it didn't have a management company established, it appeared to be done on the fly. And I see that just today that UBAN's JR application was rejected largely in whole. I haven't read the judgment, but I've read quotes from the judgment, and I must admit I'm pleased the rate payer to see that a cost award in favour of QLEC. So that's the story behind these day shows. At least there's of course another appeal.
Thank you very much. On your most recent discussion here, parallel that you're drawing quick one for interesting, and I could you describe for us in terms of what you see as the identity, as opposed to just specifically the physical aspects of living in a rural lifestyle area, so that in paragraph 12 you've got this will flow on the text, this will have a flow on the text of the identity of existing living areas. Can you explain what you mean by identity?
Yeah, what I'm trying to describe here is a little bit abstract, but I actually think it's real. This is my own personal view from my professional experience being involved in land development and living on a local basis on my own travelling. That's not specifically directed at rural residential living, that's at living in general. We'll call it urbanised living. So to have diversity in living environments is something that I think is important, particularly for the Queenstown Lakes District. I feel that visitors identify with that diversity of living, and if we grade proposition of land use to the point that I think has been proposed by you then, who we have activities that are on the same footing as farming being permitted, and well, sorry, any activity, any other activity farming on the same footing as being permitted in a rural area. As a threat, not, it's not about being a threat to rural residential living or where I live, it's about reinforcing the styles of living and diversity in the district as a whole, and that's what I'm concerned will be lost if we go down this line. But I apologise that I'm an engineer trying to explain something that's a more of a social context, but that's something that I do identify with, but I'm struggling to put the words around it. I tried here. I apologise if I'm not articulating it that well.
I'm impressed.
I just want to check that you were an engineer.
Can I just follow on? Is it in part your concern with that it becoming homogenous?
Very much so.
To put in a single word.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm laughing because I actually took part in the debate. Mr. Page is sitting behind me. He scored some good points on me referring to homogenous as homogeneous.
you might recall that.
At engineering school, we often refer to being homogeneous and serious. But thanks, Commissioner. That's my concern, is that if we end up with a lot of stain, then this might turn into a lot.
And so, following on from that, earlier on in that paragraph, you talk about the social benefits of living in a community like that. I guess, sort of, again,
I guess what I see there is that you can, at different stages of your life, you want to live different places. You don't necessarily want to have an 800 square metre lot that you mow the lawns on when you're 23 or 24 and flat or whatever you're doing. And you need to provide a real diversity of living environments for a population to thrive. And I'm concerned, so this comes back to this whole issue of diversity and creating character. And so within that, yes, you can have rural residential living, which has its own environment as well. And it's not everybody's cup of tea, but some people's cup of tea. And so you're trying to provide for a range of social demands in the living environment of the district. And, right now, obviously, we have a major problem with affordable housing, and I accept that. Simply turning the taps on to generate, allotment sizes is a very blunt tool in my view. I won't diverge into politics here, but I think that there's other ways to produce outcomes, and particularly I think quite unique to, we talked about Queenstown and that affordable housing debate can focus on Queenstown. Suggesting that you address affordable housing by creating other transport issues instead of concentrating more intense development around existing infrastructure, it doesn't make sense to me. It makes much more sense to locate it, wind up into existing developed areas. That's my own view. It addresses a lot of other infrastructural demands, potentially, more precious. So, again, you still need to release your name at times on the edge of the existing zoned areas. I'm really getting myself in trouble here with the way outside my evidence. So.
You're not here as an expert.
No.
No, let me say it.
Thank you,
Mr. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Submission. There's a couple of things I want to clarify. In your original submission, the approach will look like a sort of slightly altered version of that 26.
Right.
Right through the middle, we've got a big notation there that Main North Fairgrounds Road, the JAD rural zone submission, and it's all perfectly pink. And according to the legend, on there it's as close to town centres as any other colour. I'm assuming you've either marked out or that.
Yeah, that's been coloured, I think, for like 5 years in land holdings, just looking from a distance, that's testing my eyes over the two. But that's not intended to be, so that will be probably a PDF of the plan map.
Yep.
We highlighted the year burn. That's what we've highlighted the year burn landholding, and it's a coincidence that it's that mauve colour that matches the down centre boundary. It's not any that you mean that we're making a submission.
Okay. Right.
But thanks for pointing that out.
Striking resemblance to that rather than the vision. Thank you. The other thing I want to clarify was in your written submission that we pre-circulated, basically the outcome you're after is the retention of the provisions as they're written in the PDP. If I just look at the second half of paragraph 10 of your written evidence, talking positive light about the status quo, an efficient way of reinforcing and providing for farming activities. If you just clarify what you mean by the status quo, is that the PDP provision?
It is. Well, I guess what I'm highlighting is that I guess the district plan is approaching the PDP, controlled it in that way. I just might be using that as an example to highlight how the benefits were recognised for farming activities and rural landowners in that way. But yes, I support the PDP.
And then again, just paragraph 7 of your written evidence, the second half of that paragraph, you list out a series of activities that require a rural location. I'm not sure that all of those activities do necessarily require a rural location as such, but is that a proper summary of the activities which you think could strengthen the rural environment if the provisions were loosened up?
It's really just put forward as an example. I mean, it's very hard, isn't it, to identify all activities in the way that the word is drafted. So I can't say that's the extent of my analysis. I think you've got to go there, but it just illustrates that there's some of the activities, and it probably highlights the problem with introducing words like other activities that require rural location.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'd be any lawyer that would argue what requiring a rural location on that. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Suppose there's a lot on that.
Thank you.
Differentiate and support the type of dense living that is desired in the cities. Are you when you state that, are you being dense in the term of the ways Swiss settlements are dense, or dense in the term of the way New Zealand settlements are dense in the world?
Well, no, I mean it is Swiss. The way that they choose to live. Often you would have a situation where you have a settlement that literally could be less than 1 kilometre away from another one, and there will be a barn sitting in the mistake. Very basic terms to settlement, and then 800 or 900 metres over here, another settlement, and a barn in the middle. I won't bore you with the details.
No, the other commissioners.
Yeah. So And I guess the behavioural patterns, I was lost to play people that they're very comfortable living and they adapt to living in narrow streets. Pedestrianising, their urban centres, they walk rather than drive, all sorts of things like that. Having the open space reinforces those types of social patterns and suggests that this is the right way to be living. It's very dangerous to take something that occurs in another country with a very different economic driver than apply it here. It just struck me, there's no incentive to observe it while we're there, and I guess what I'm doing is just trying to share that observation with you as a panel and the submission and talking about. It's sort of an adjunct to the primary thrust of my submission.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for accommodating my late.
That's okay.
I do have copies of my hearing submission today. I didn't intend to take up a lot of the panel's time on this submission, mainly because Fish and Game, the Otago Fish and Game Council, is broadly supportive of the proposed specific plan. Our focus primarily at Fish and Game is that most of our time, in the plain sense, tends to go on Otago Regional Council matters rather than District Council matters. But there were sort of three areas that I thought the plan needed a bit of work and was potentially deficient, and I just wanted to take you through those today. So our submission in 2015 focused on the following issues, focused on the need to give effect to policy 2.1.6 and 4.3.2 of the proposed regional policy statement for Otago, and that's primarily to recognise the value of tussock grasslands and the water yield that comes from those. It's a particularly significant value in this district and in other parts of Otago as well. And it's a value that has recently been recognised at a higher level by the regional policy plan for Otago. And I suspect that those two planning processes happened after this district plan was developed. The second thing we had suggested, or the concern we had from a Fish and Game perspective, was the district plan at the moment doesn't give effect or doesn't recognise explicitly the values of trout and salmon, or the trout and salmon habitat as provided for in Section 7H of the RMA. It's primarily a drafting thing. There's no particular problem with the thrust of the objectives and policies, but it does need support out with particularly the things to stream flow clearance, recurring vegetation clearance and margins. There's no effect here based on the habitat of trout and salmon on the plan currently. So that's a requirement of Section 7H of the Act. And lastly, there's just a minor point I'll make on the issue around unformed legal roads, the value for access and potential obstruction over those roads. So my suggestion around giving effect to the two policies of the proposed PS was primarily to just make an amendment to your objective 33.2.2 and the addition of a third criterion there, which was effectively to say avoid the clearance or alteration of such a grassland where it will have adverse effects on water year values and dry catchments. And that's effectively just the other text of the RPS. You'll see our outlines from the submission of those two policies and what they state need to be given effect to in the district plan. Effectively, that is one side. It's the other side of the argument of what this district plan I consider does quite well, which is to give effect to the concerns around Wild and Conifer Street and Wild and Pine Street that has an effect on water yield. The conversion of tussock grasslands to pasture has a similar effect. And so it's effectively just the other side of high country management. That's the tussock grasslands point. I did have some concern that at no point did the district plan give explicit recognition to the habitats of trout and salmon. Requirements section 7H of the RMA, that'll be known to all of you. I just was concerned that for a particular type of activity, streamside vegetation clearance, riparian margins, any activity nominal at the moment, the only test is on indigenous vegetation, and it doesn't reference, apart from in a couple of the significant natural areas where the values of fish, habitat of trout and salmon is referenced in those areas, there's no general test to look at the effects of vegetation clearance on stream side on the habitat of trout and salmon. And considering that that is a major tourism, that guided fishing is a major tourism activity within this region, recreational activity as well, just thought that was an omission from the plan. But it's one that's relatively easily fixed because fish and game only really requires that assessment for a particular class of activities, just for things like vegetation clearance, not general activities. We're happy to continue our work with the Regional Council on wider matters of catchments, and that's not been the function of the QLBC. So I suggested here, in my point 8, how you could rectify that omission. And the last point I want to make is surrounds the issue of unformed legal roads and their value, not just for current providing access to lakes and rivers and their margins currently, but also their potential future value. It's a particular issue in this district where we've got relatively rapid development, by rivers, and on formerly part of the landscape that was much, much more open and extensively farmed. We are enclosing this landscape as the development continues. One of the concerns I had is this district plan, and it's the current district plan as well, doesn't have an access chapter or a recreation chapter, or even, doesn't even have a transport chapter. And so it's actually difficult to deal with a general policy around unformed legal roads.
I think Mr. Wilson, also the transport chapter, is going to be in the second
part. Oh, second part. Sure.
This is why it's not here at the moment.
Okay. That might be a place to pick up on this, but I had a suggestion. And at the moment, you've got two tests for unformed legal roads. One is the outstanding natural landscapes, and the other one is the rural, the RLCs, the rural landscape classifications. The moment the test is basically almost to look at a development and see if there's an unformed legal road running past it, is to look at that development and see if that development is going to have, or the unformed legal road is going to have a negative effect on that development. The suggestion I had was potentially to change that test and to look at the effect that the developments might have on the unformed legal road next to it. And that would just elevate the value of that unformed legal road for current and future access any time that a consent was being sought for subdivision or land use over that piece of land that was next to the unformed legal road. And to me it seems a logical approach given the difficulty of dealing with that issue in the current district plan. So those are the three primary issues I wanted to touch upon. But apart from that, you know, actually having broader support of the Withers and get it.
In paragraph, I'm assuming it was of the submission, I'm thinking, clarify that now. In 33, can you identify for me, 33.2.2, is that the objective that you're...
33.2.2 is the objective, yes.
Right. And so, is the wording that you're suggesting to go up where the objective is, or is it to be added as a policy? I'm just trying to clarify.
The wording would be as a new criterion under that objective. So at the moment there's three criterion, 3 points under that objective, 1, 2, and 3.
They're the policies?
Yeah. It would be as an addition to that list of policies. You would have it as a full policy effectively. No, this is where we sort of get caught up by, you know, section 6 of the RMA for the functioning of the river, functioning of the catchment, stream side vegetation, which is generally going to have a beneficial effect on the functioning of that river, regardless of whether the tree was indigenous in New Zealand or came from overseas. It's just that our policy tests within the RMA require us, particularly the district plan level, to focus on indigenous vegetation, given that it's under more threat than exotic vegetation. But the RPS for Otago references all, makes mention of all vegetation types where they're contributing to the ecosystem function within a catchment. So they've got that particular focus on indigenous. So the thrust is slightly different, whereas this plan is mostly focused around indigenous vegetation, but I think that's just where that focus might have gone possibly a wee bit far, given, you know, given the function of the need to ensure that we still got function of catchments. So the fishing game, we would probably only be interested in stream side vegetation clearance within 20 metres of the river, that's how they're going to take from grass and habitat. We would be careful to limit our involvement to only that. We wouldn't want to be involved or on any consents that would be greater than that.
Okay.
I think, to be fair.
And then just recent commission, you brought up a point around the value of fishing and guiding through this region.
Yes.
Do you have numbers for the number of fishing licences purchased across the town lakes?
I've got a few numbers actually, and I can provide those as both academic references and also references from our fishing license database, and provide us a panel of it, so I'm happy to do that as a third submission. We would be looking at across fairly guided angling across this district, quoted by the Professional Fishing Guide Association, is in the ballpark $50 million a year. That's guided angling through the Professional Fishing Guide Association, ballpark $30 million.
Total value to the region
will be in the order of about $130 million. If I can get you the exact figures, because it's actually University of Otago paper at the economics department on that. That economic analysis was done a couple of years ago. And it was broken down with district boundary, so I believe that's probably actually what you're after. Yeah. You can make a note to provide us a panel.
Could you get that to the seminar by the end of this week?
Yes.
If all possible, please. The seminar is there.
Yes.
But the normal email address would be there.
Thank you for your submission and evidence. Just turning to your written evidence that you handed up today, paragraph 7.
Yes.
I make a point about not explicitly reference recognition of habitats of the salmon. I take it you've probably got a broader view than just inside this district. Are you aware of other districts that are explicitly referencing and recognising those habitats throughout the district and with your processes?
Oh, I see what you're getting at. My use of the term explicit is just basically to say that while your plan does not have the words trout and salmon habitat within it, the policies are not working against it either. That's what I'm referring to. I'm not referring to the need to go out and map trout and salmon habitat across the district.
Another way of looking at this, we can take everything and put it in the act, cut it out and put it into the plan.
Of course.
But that isn't really achieving
no.
Every state in the act. So I'm just wondering if there's other examples that you can point
to. I think the closest is the example, and the practical example is there might be a stream flow vegetation clearance activity. Someone coming along wants to clear vegetation across the stream, but it might just happen to be a really important spawning site for fish. So the clearance of that vegetation means that spawning site can become subject to sedimentation. There's no buffer between land use and the stream that was formerly provided by the vegetation. And that removal can actually result in a degradation of the waterway. So if the length of that buffer, set that margin, that interface between what's happening on the land and what's happening in the stream. And at the moment, Fish and Game would not have any ability through the consenting process set up under this plan to actually provide input on a consent of that nature. Whereas currently, it doesn't happen very often, we have three or four times a year. Probably we do.
So you're looking for an opportunity?
Well, we're just looking for an opportunity from a particular type of activity to be able to provide some input. At the moment that process is working pretty well. They're all non-notified consents. But it just gives us some assurance that we can continue to fulfill our statutory function.
Okay, and just following from that, aside from including the words that are in 7H of the Act, paraphrasing or directly copying them, is it in your opinion that the plan generally goes some way towards protecting the habitat that we consider?
Yes, yes. The plan is, we'll draw the support, identify three areas where it can be improved, but we are broadly supportive of that. Another way of doing it, if you're concerned around not wanting to restate the act, which I understand entirely, would be just to say habitats of freshwater fish, because that also catches quite important non-migratory galaxidates and other native fish values that are present in this region and nationally or critically endangered in some cases. And that would cover off on both, because one of the rules, of course, of the RMA is that it doesn't really recognise native fish.
Thank you.
Thank you, Angela. Thank you. Is this the mayor's
work
here?
Just one more question in terms of your recent submissions and proposal around objective 33.223.
Yes.
In terms of avoidance and clearance or alteration of tussock grassland, how would you test whether or not it has an adverse effect on water use? What would that, would any clearance always affect it and therefore?
Difficulty is that it's a cumulative loss that's measured in not months or not weeks or months, it's measured in years. It's a cumulative loss that would happen. It would happen with the slow and gradual incremental clearance of tussock grasslands to pasture or going the other way of wild inclines. That loss would be measured, the water yield would happen over probably over a 5 to 10, 15 year period, and it would be only measurable on that time frame rather than on a shorter time frame. And that's one of the difficulties of why it's such a difficult value to manage and protect within a planning framework. They accept that. Because the effect of it, the effect of that loss and change is the cable time.
From the research and science around it, it actually that could you go as far as saying that any tussock clearance is a loss of potential wood yield presence in that catchment?
In the sub catchment, in the first order stream that's coming from that, the high country hydrologist would be able to measure that, yes. It depends on what standard you're looking to measure it at. So if it's in the sub-catchment, even if it's a small sub-catchment, it is going to have an effect, yes.
My name is Clive Nailsworth. I've lived in the district for 45 years. The last 38 years I've resided at the old Van Laden homestead past the Coronet Peak Cernoff. Over the years my wife Shane has planted extensive gardens, including a field of lavender, built a lavender oil distillery and opened a farm shop. So we're reliant on maintaining a tranquil, pleasant environment. I became involved in helicopter noise pollution during the Christmas New Year 2006. Al fresco garden lunches, my family were shattered by low-flying helicopters lining up the land of the tourist zone at Downey's Point. The PLDC health and safety officer emailed saying the operator did not have consent for the landing. But a week later, the CEO emailed saying they had consent. About 4 years of litigation costing the Upper Point residents $50,000 and the ratepayers approximately 250,000 supporting the helicopter operator, the helipad was closed down. During 2009, we had to oppose the introduction of Plane Change 27A, which tries to introduce the New Zealand standard 680794, which is the noise management and land use planning for helicopter landing areas. This would have allowed, according to a noise consultant, 20 landings or 40 movements per day at this point. 2 years of litigation and a further cost of $10,000 from the Harvest Point residents only confirmed the current noise conditions would not be overridden by the helicopter concern. I was also involved in the litigation concerning the PLDC allowing unlimited helicopter landings on the Dunlop Recreational Reserve, another cost to the ratepayers of around $400,000. The website www.queenstownnoise.co.nz contains most of the above legal decisions and useful information on noise. So, I've acquired a reasonable understanding of the law and jargon surrounding helicopter noise pollution. The latest episode proposes the introduction of informal airports, allowing 3 landings per week, 500 metres from a national boundary, consented solely on the opinion of a noise consultant. Once again, we're told we must adopt New Zealand Standard 680794, noise management of land use plan for helicopter landing areas. Anyone who is shocked at the remarkable park will understand how much noise helicopters generate taking off and landing 500 metres away at the airport. Section 32 of the RMA requires that an evaluation report must contain a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental effects that are anticipated from the implementation of this proposal. In my opinion, the following are a list of points that have not been considered. No evidence of community support for informal airports. No explanation why the current noise controls have been discarded after threatening the community for generations. A lack of understanding that people live in rural areas for peace and quiet. No evaluation of the cumulative effects of numerous habitats all over the district. No explanation why we must adopt any of the New Zealand Standard 60794, noise management, land use planning of the helicopter landing area, and fails to mention the standard has already been rejected by the community in 2011. No evaluation or explanation of the difference between the existing sound levels and New Zealand Standard 680794. The report must show that the community wishes to adopt the standard and explain that the council is not legally bound to adopt the standard. The report has to prove the community is aware of the provisions of NZ. And whether the standard would increase noise pollution. The short answer is the community has no understanding of the standard because to obtain a copy costs $70 and the standard was written by the helicopter industry and never signed off by the Ministry of Health. The report should have stated that NZS807 averages helicopter noise over 24 hours rather than 15 minutes current regulations require. In my opinion, 3 flights a week is just trying to get a fucking resort. As Mr. Childs, the Council of Noise Consultants, explained, if we adopt NZ6807, then a 500 metre separation would allow 10 flights a day or 140 takeoff and landings per week. I'm loath to say that my opinion matches Blair and Charles' reports of bias, lack transparency, and detail required by the Act. And in all fair fairness, they should declare who they're representing. The whole issue is simply about noise pollution. The fact you cannot see it, taste it, or smell it may explain why you've not received as much attention as other types of pollution. Queenstown is striving to become a mature resort. Aspen, our sister city, banned all helicopter flyovers and landings, including at their airport, because they are serious about noise pollution. To conclude, I consider it imperative we will try to retain the status quo for future generations and our visitors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Would the when you maintaining the status quo, do you mean what's in the current Oxford district plan or the proposed?
The existing in the Oxford district scheme, not a regulation. Would specifically say that the helicopter statute cannot override those positions, which was thrashed out of great extent in 2011.
Just to follow up on that care program a bit, it sounds like you've been involved in a long period of time now, maybe a bit of a litigation around this issue. Would you say that the status quo is currently serving you well, or would you like to see a move more towards the Aspen City response?
We've got to have a set of regulations, noise regulations, which are set in concrete, and that everybody can understand them. And if you want to breach those noise conditions, then you have to apply for consent. Like everybody else. The helicopter operators, they want to be exempt from paranoid regulations because they have, the only way that they can land these informal airports is to introduce the helicopter standard, which raises the noise threshold unseen time. Because at the moment, the noise is tested and averaged over 15 minutes. But they want their standards said, no, we average it over 24 hours. The way you're sleeping, it's all dissipating away.
So is that your understanding of the main difference between the way that the Oxford district plan deals with noise and standards for the data set on it, the way that the average goes up by 15 minutes?
Yes, that increases noise pollution.
Thank you. Following on from that, what the noise that actually rules your cost of that, was it the landing of the helicopters, or was it also the flying over
a helicopter,
the flight path that they were taking?
They were flying very, very low over our house, and because at that time on their website they were advertising that we give you a thrilling jet-like ride with the helicopters, so they fly you all over the sky, that was proposed, and they love to fly close to the ground to give everyone a thrill. But I might add that after I complained about this and got into them for we started sorting out all this mess, they kept on doing it on purpose to intimidate myself and my family. jumping out of my head. That was so low. But they're not, really, they're helicopters.
So is there not another, is there another standard that they need to comply by in terms of how they decide on their flight path? Or is the proposal
they will tell you, the helicopter operators will tell you, but they take off and land vertically. But we've never ever seen that. The helicopters take off like a plane and just go up at a grade, covering a large distance. Now, when they're flying below 500 feet, they come under our jurisdiction. When they're above 500 feet, the RMA said, we can't say anything about it because they're overflying. As soon as they come under 500 feet, then the community has a say of what they can do.
So you think that the Office of District can come with the issue around modifying?
No. It's just implicitly when a helicopter flies below 500 feet and creates more noise from what the noise control allows, then they're not allowed to do that.
Okay, so the current cover in the opposite?
No, it's not. Helicopters, I don't think they're even mentioned, but they're pushing it all the time. And when I got involved in this, I had people ringing up all over the ringing up from all over the basin saying, well, we have helicopters landing beside us on a regular basis, what can we do about it? And I said, well, you can't, because the council is right behind them. And unfortunately, the council has been pushing this. Although the opposite district scheme says they can only land for emergency, farming, lifting, etc. Full stop. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Martin.
My name is Stuart Martin, and the reason why I'm here today is to support both proposed district plan, Chapter 22, minimum lot sizes, 5 acres and 2 hectares, and support changes in the proposed district plan to rezone land from rural general to rural lifestyle. I'd also like to get an amendment made to the rural zone, Chapter 21, and change the wording from 2 kilometre viewing to a 500 metre viewing. So that's under the rural zone 21 farm buildings, standards for farm buildings. It's called 21.5.18.
And you want that change from 2 kilometres to 5 metres?
Yes. And I'd also like to get paragraph 3 as you go down there. Privacy, outlook and rural community. That's the lead. On a lighter note, I'd just like to tell you that I lived in the Wakatipu Basin for some 27 years and have been a ratepayer at the same time. And I absolutely love living here and I think it's a fantastic place. My wife and I have raised 2 children here, both attended kindergarten, primary school and secondary school. We own a rural property of some 14 hectares at the end of Morton Ferry Road. The land is presently zoned rural funeral. We would like in the future the land to be zoned rural livestock. As would our neighbours, the Bunn family, who are third generation farmers sitting on a large parcel of land waiting to be rezoned. The Morton Ferry area is already cut into smaller rural lifestyle blocks, all of different sizes. The area is generally flat, north facing, and has plenty of capacity to absorb more lifestyle blocks. One of the big benefits of living there is the cycle trail. The cycle trail is at the northern boundary of our property, running along a lower level track above the river. We as neighbours, collectively, the Bunn family and myself, see the huge economical benefit to the community for the cycle trail and the land along the cycle trail providing amenities for trail users. And we would like to see in the future some kind of zoning like rural vista with bike-hire cash and visitor accommodation. This will enable more economic activity to develop along the trail. Eventually, when it connects to Cromwell down the gorge, it will end up being a tourism icon, a fantastic asset for the community. One of the main reasons we would like our land rezoned into a rural lifestyle is so that our 2 children can stay in the Wakatipu. Otherwise, there is no way our kids, who are locals, can get a start here. It's pretty sad when local kids who grow up here, born here, gone to school here, can't afford to buy a house here. Everybody in this room who has children must have all faced the same problem. We come here, well, I come here as a tradesman 27 years ago and got a start. The next generation of kids, they can't afford $700,000 to get going. So the only way my kids can get a start is if we subdivide to 5 acre lot tops and try and get them going. But it's all about, at the end of the day, supply and demand. And we need to rezone more land so you don't create a huge demand. You cannot leave it to the housing trust to try and solve a simple problem.
Thank you. Could I just confirm, in terms of the submissions that we've got, submission number 38, the first one talks about fully supporting the plan change in its entirety.
Yes.
The second one refers to chapter 27 subdivisions and lot size minimums.
Yes.
Is that all in terms of the submissions that there are?
I
thought
there was another one.
Oh, okay. It might be that I just don't have it. You don't happen to have a copy?
No, I don't have it with me, but I can certainly.
Oh, yes. I think Council Officer should be able to find that for us. No, okay.
to the south and west of Mount Barker Road and State Highway opposite Warrington Airport. One of the reasons why Cripple Station is particularly sensitive at the moment to some of the things which I'm going to discuss is that Cripple, along with a number of its landowning colleagues in the catchment, are currently going through a process with the Otago Regional Council to renew its mining privileges, which are again permits, as I'm sure you'll recall, under the Act, which are due to expire in 2021. That is a statutory exercise for everyone to go through, but one of the dynamics of it is an intense focus by the Regional Council on matters of water use efficiency. And what is apparent from what I will discuss in my submissions is that there is a potential for a real disjunct between the policy focus that the Regional Council is applying and what is proposed in this district plan. At its broadest level, that particular issue is really a call for policy integration, which appears to have been overlooked. So that has been one of the sources of focus, and of course the Innes case from recent times in the Upper Clutha has also been a centre of tradition for farmers in this district. And in particular, Dr. Estes' participation in that process as an expert witness has given us cause for thought about how the indigenous vegetation provisions work, and that is the reason for him to be here today to give you the benefit of his experience on that. So, that's the context. Moving to my written submissions. The indigenous vegetation provisions as they relate to land outside the SNA, the significant natural areas, or below 1,070 metres in elevation, especially not achieved the purpose of the Act, in particular the obligation to safeguard the life supporting capacity of soils.
Is that the only purpose of the Act?
No, but that is one which we say has been overlooked.
So, yes. That part. Override any of the other parts?
No, it doesn't. But again, if we want to integrate all of the Council's functions under Part 2 of the Act, we say that a proper application of its, all of its parts would yield a different result. The two methods. So those two methods, SNAs and the elevation control and rules we submit, address the significance elements in Section 6C and meet Council's protection obligations. The remaining submissions address the inclusion of irrigation and the clearance of vegetation, and the inconsistency between the indigenous vegetation provisions. Now,
sorry, could I just interrupt you? The definition of clearance of vegetation, can you direct me to the correct chart?
Where I have marked it is on page 3320 of the 42A report. Version I have in front of me.
Can I see a copy of the proposed plan on the paper?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you can the same document, it might be easier.
Thank you. copy that I have just given in the definition section on page 2. So page 2-7 is the definition of clearance of vegetation at the top of that page. And the reference to irrigation is in the second clause of that definition, which says clearance of vegetation includes the deliberate application of water where it would change the ecological conditions such that the resident indigenous plants are killed by competitive exclusion.
So it includes the clearance of any vegetation where it's the direct deliberate application of water, but it would only be, the only concern is where it's the resident indigenous plants. Is that a correct reading?
The definition includes the where you irrigate and that has the effect of causing exotic species to outcompete native species, that phenomenon has been specifically included in the definition. Now, there are again thresholds which need to be applied in the rules, and I'll come to those.
Can I just ask this? It talks about the direct application of water for the purposes of clearing vegetation. It doesn't just relate to indigenous vegetation.
No, because the definition says such that the resident indigenous plants are killed. So if we happen to kill all exotics at the same time,
that doesn't kill it.
It doesn't matter.
That's the question.
Yeah. Yeah. An example might be, and forgive me if I'm stepping outside my brief and Peter can correct me, if Horatium were killed off by the application of water, then it's not a matter which is Horatium's in, but I believe it is a species, but thank you. If Horatium happened to be killed by competitive exclusion, that isn't something which the definition deals with.
So if you are clearing vegetation through the application of water and we've got it, that's sufficient?
Sorry,
if you are clearing exotic vegetation by the direct deliberate application of water,
yes,
then that would be permitted.
That's not controlled by the
control climate.
No.
The reason I'm asking you, this is sort of in the legal territory, I think, the deliberate application. But you need to, under the law, you need to be deliberately doing something for the purpose of killing off the resident indigenous plants.
Well,
the way that you spray irrigation, the way that's your intention.
The way I see the drafting of the definition, the application of the water has to be deliberate. But there doesn't need to be an intent to kill off the indigenous plants.
Sorry, is it linked at all with the deliberate application of water where it would, are those two methods linked? The deliberate application of water, as you just said, is one part, but it's for where it would. Is that your purpose?
Well, the where it would need to be followed through, because it says where it would change the ecological condition such that resinous and indigenous plants are killed. And frankly, the whole thing is called politics, because one doesn't irrigate when you've got to change the ecological conditions.
That's not correct, actually. If you already have a pasture and you irrigate it, you're not irrigating it to change the ecological circumstance. There may be occasions where it happens, but that's not the purpose.
Yes. Although what we're seeing here, sir, and again I deal with this in my submissions, is where we're going from a irrigation regime that is the traditional wild flood or water dike irrigation through the spray regime. because if we've already got locally established spray irrigation going on here, then presumably people's going to lose it in this run. What my client's concerned about is where the regional council requires an irrigator to convert from wild flood and water dike to spray, otherwise they do not get access to water. Then they now have another regime under this plan through this deposition to overcome this inconsistency. That's the phenomenon we're interested in.
I thought that lawfully established by that team member that a permitted activity under the regional plan for that water.
No. What I mean, under your opposite plan,
Sorry, it's not my plan.
I was trying to differentiate between this and the regional one. Under the Queenstown opposite plan, there is no control of the phenomenon of irrigation. So this is new.
So isn't the thing there, they're not controlling water. Are they trying to control the clearance of vegetation?
Well, I'm going to make submission on that as we go about whether this is in fact a regional council function they're dealing with here. My submission will be this is, and it'll be on the scope of what you can do.
So the protection of vegetation is not a the protection of clearance of vegetation. It's not a function of
that. No, it is clearly a function of chemicals. No, we'll come to that. Bear with me. We'll need to work it through. Controlling the clearance of vegetation and a species of land use is squarely a matter that this council can deal with through this plan. My solution will be controlling the use of water.
But I think the thing for your face is that the definition does not purport to control the use of water.
Well,
it does not require a discharge consent, does it? That controls the use of water.
Or a water permit?
Well, it purports to control the discharge of water. It says that.
No, it says you can discharge it if you just can't put it on that plan. That's not the same thing. I mean, if you consider, and I don't think you have to use synopsis, the definition of use in Section 2 of the Act.
Well, not in this context.
Because use includes deposit a substance in, on, or under land. So in terms of Section 9, the district is entitled to consider the depositing of any substance on the land, the use of land.
Well, I'll come to where I say the difference is between Section 30 and 31. But there's two elements to where we're going with the definitions. The first is, we say that this should either in a matter of law is or should be regarded as a regional council. Okay? The second, and this is not to rest me given this form, but to follow the theme, there isn't an evidence base to say that there is an indigenous vegetation clearance issue that has to be managed because the same competitive exclusion phenomenon occurs whether you apply water or not.
That's a different issue. Yeah. I want to get some law. And one of the questions I've had, having considered your synopsis in relation to Section 30 and 31, are you suggesting that there's a mutually exclusive functions of the regional council and the district council?
In relation to water, yes.
But how, I'm at a loss as to how the district is controlling water. And I'll put it to you this way.
I recently heard an application for the discharge of effluent from a wastewater disposal system by spray irrigation onto pasture, and within the pasture was a wetland, and both, and the district council, both as applicant and as regulatory authority, proposed conditions on the designation that the application, that that area not be irrigated. Are you telling me that that's just the council that misinterpreted the law? The regional council agreed with that approach as well in that instance.
That was in relation to a designation, you say?
Yes, which is a land use.
Yes. I need to consider whether the use of the irrigation of effluent puts into category. I don't know the answer, and I haven't thought that through.
Certainly, the reason council for seeking the discharge was because the discharge of contaminant that made into water.
Yes.
But that's a different situation in the sense sort of the land use has to come.
So what additional utility was there in having an additional district layer of regulation?
Well, the district was concerned with the biodiversity aspects of the wetland. The regional council concerns were the nitrification of the groundwater. Wondering whether we have a straw man here, or is it a real issue?
Well, the reason why I think there is a real issue is because the circumstances in which water is used for irrigation purposes are very carefully managed by the regional council through its processes, and it seems to us, in reflecting on what is now proposed in the definition, that we've now got a whole other layer of regulation in relation to the use of water, which is effectively unheralded, and there doesn't appear to be a recognition that the regional council has functions to exercise in relation to that water and its use and its discharge, and that it doesn't seem to us that the consequence of attempting to control water through land use provisions for other reasons has been contemplated by reference to the higher order instruments.
Perhaps you could help us, because we're not seeing a sign reading the regional water plan. With the renewal of the mining rates, those that our water permits take.
Yes.
Is there any consent required from the regional council to discharge that water?
There are rules in the regional plan of order, which manage the discharge of water to lands for irrigation purposes. In the particular circumstances of the crippled water project, no, there are not additional layer of consents required for use of irrigation as a discharge permit.
Is there any provision then in the regional plan, in the regional water plan, which would go any way to considering whether indigenous vegetation would be adversely affected?
No.
So the regional council is not considering this matter at all?
Not in this context, no.
So you're suggesting that in terms of the RMA, which has the matter in part in section 6, and also later in section 31 in relation to biodiversity, that it is not dealt with by the regional council and it should be ruled by the district council. Is that your fundamental submission?
No. The submission is that there is the absence of rules dealing with this particular matter in the regional plan of water. Does not mean that it becomes the district council's job to deal with an issue that the regional council has chosen not to make rules about. It's not an omission by mistake. It's consistent with this regional policy statement.
So give us the proposed regional policy statement.
Well, I don't know the answer to that.
Can I help you? Possibly. Where it says, under the roles and responsibilities, the city and district councils will specify objectives, policy for neighbours, for the control of the use of land, for the maintenance of indigenous biodiversity on all land outside the CMA and against the lakes and rivers.
Yes.
So that related to the function and action of the district council in this case.
My permission that that statement is perfectly consistent with the first paragraph of the occurrence of vegetation and not consistent with the second.
But the review of spraying, the first part includes spraying with a herbicide.
Yes.
Wouldn't that need a discharge permit for it to go for a particular, I don't know, volume level or something under a discharge to land plan?
Well, it certainly falls under section 31 F, discharge of contaminant.
Yes, it is. There are rules about herbicide application. I can't tell you what they are.
No, I can
read the premise from this.
But you don't have any problem with that being this definition?
No, because, and the reason for that is because of the explicit reference in section 30 to the use and discharge of water being specified as a regional function and not as a district function.
So the same subcategory. Spoken on top of page 2 of your submissions.
Recommence paragraph 5. regional and territorial functions can and do overlap. Territorial rules that overlap regional functions are permissible, provided that they are for purposes of carrying out their own functions. The Canterbury Regional Council case dealt with the direct control of the use of land for the avoidance of the effects of natural hazards. So the overlap in functions is clear and obvious. Here, a boundary of the QLDC has functions concerned with managing the use of land to maintain indigenous biodiversity. The third paragraph of the definition contains examples. But there are no relevant territorial authority functions in relation to the use and discharge of water for land. Managing the effects of variation on the biological conditions of the land is squarely, in my submission uniquely, a regional council matter. If there is a need for the better integration of the use of water and the use of land, then that integration falls more logically with the regional council under section 31A.
Sorry, Mr. Page, my apologies for keeping this one correct. In terms of the effects of irrigation, when farmers irrigate, do they add anything to the water when it's irrigating, fertilizer or that kind of thing?
Not really.
The concept of fertilization happens in varying to a degree. Which is effectively applying effluent in a dilute form through where the irrigation occurs. It's not commonly resistant, I understand.
I understand it is on the hardware plan.
Sorry, carry on.
So on page 3, and the bold material you'll recognise are from the, I've simply copied and pasted those from the synopsis and then enlarged upon them. The submission again relates to the control of irrigation by vegetation clearance. The National Policy Statement of Freshwater Management has an objective to improve and maximise the efficient allocation and efficient use of water.
Yes? You've mentioned this efficient use of water again. If it is not applied, how is that inefficient? Isn't it more efficient to only apply it in those areas where there is pasture?
What I'm referring to is the efficiency in terms of the selection of the irrigation method. And in particular, the regional council uses a body of work carried out by an organisation called Aquamic, which produced a report in 2008. Which set irrigation efficiency targets in terms of plant availability of water at root zone level. And so, in terms of the regional council's use of efficient use of water, that is what drives its decision making over the volumes of water that might be allocated by way of a consent. Is how efficiently is it applied? Relative to its likelihood of being taken up by plants. But your point is, why would we irrigate something where there isn't pasture grasses that could take up the water? Well, yes, that's an obvious point to be made. Of course, the purpose of the exercise is to irrigate pasture grass.
But if the land contains indigenous vegetation, that the plan says should be retained and not cleared, then surely it is inefficient to apply water to that because it is not productive land in terms of the regional council's definition of efficiency.
Well, that's probably straying into a subject that Dr. Espy is more capable of dealing with than I am.
Meaning the immediacy, not the long term that Dr. Espy discusses in his evidence.
So
the ultimate point at which it would become efficient, but
yes, but what we are concerned with is the irrigation of land which is in the basin lowland and terraces, which has for a very long time been used for agriculture, and which we have pasture grasses and possibly in some areas, although lots to find there, remnants of indigenous vegetation dispersed amongst the pasture grasses. So that's the phenomenon that we are concerned with. So the purposes of applying water isn't to kill off the native, it's to make the something grow. Now, efficiency in the sense of the regional policy framework relates to using the water in such a way that is best available for the plant material sphere. The regional framework doesn't differentiate between native, indigenous and exotic, but as a matter of economic common sense, farmers aren't going to be irrigating land that doesn't produce palatable fodder. Does that address the point that you were making?
I think the real another issue that you raised is not the irrigation per se, but the nature of the ground upon which it's irrigated, and the whether or not the clearance of vegetation occurs in a way that breaches the rules. Isn't that the real issue? If you have a mixture of exotics and indigenous vegetation, as I understand the rules, there are circumstances where clearance is permitted to certain amounts.
Yes.
As a right.
Depending on the species mix.
Yes, depending on the species mix. There are other areas where with the species it would be severely limited. Particularly, as I understand it, the lowland and dry vegetation is common, or reasonably common, in the upper Cooper. But in these days it's not so common. Would that be what we're really talking about?
Yes, we're talking about that. But I'm not sure that detracts from the point I'm trying to make, that we have a regional policy framework that is encouraging a form of irrigation in preference to the historical irrigation practices of the strip. And what I'm trying to do is draw a contrast between that policy direction that all farming people in this district who have mining privileges are required to pursue if they want to carry on irrigation, and what the definition of the proposed district plan now does to that policy direction. I'm trying to say that the policy that this does is inconsistent with a deliberate program that the regional council is running to say, if you're going to build tide water, you must do it in a way that effectively causes competitive exclusion.
Isn't the regional council to use the water consistent with I suppose, wouldn't organised irrigation be even more detrimental to the indigenous vegetation that could be affected by the river application of water? Then the clearly more efficient and low quantities of water discreetly sprayed in the appropriate places approach which the regional council is pursuing?
Well, the answer is apparently not, because much of the land, and many can speak on behalf of where irrigation has occurred directly or crippled, that could potentially have remnants of indigenous species has been irrigated in the past. And if those native species continue to exist, then they haven't been competitively excluded by an irrigation technique. Now, if the use of spray causes more vigorous growth along with pasture management through oversowing and top dressing, and that causes the competitive exclusion, then that's a phenomenon which is captured by the Kerens rule.
Is there, in fact, raising the issue of fertilisation, but that is more a problem of the Kerens rule, that the council is seeking to reduce the potential for competitive growth by exotics? There is no control of that rule. About the application of fertiliser. Now, Dr. Lesby may be the right person to answer
yes.
that, but I would have thought that that would achieve the same ends as might be achieved by the application of water.
Between
the detrimental ends, if you like.
Well, between Mandy and Peter, I am the best qualified to say that
fertilizer, if you've got fertilizer and you've got no water,
that's the combination of the two.
Yeah. Not the petrol and not the
I can certainly comment on that because that's an area of my expertise. In dry land systems such as the sorting application of fertilizer, changes the competitive relationships of species, and that changes the structure, it changes is the species composition, and it changes the frequency and abundance of certain indigenous species, particularly on the environments which are under threat in the atmosphere for the water. So it does so in dry land situations, and also that's on irrigation.
And just to be clear, is it so that does fertilisation give a competitive advantage to exotics over the indigenous island species?
The answer to that depends on which individual species we're considering.
Right.
The application of fertilising increases the abundance and the vigor of indigenous species. For example, application of fertilizer increases the stature of indigenous tussocks. It also increases the frequency and abundance and vigor of a lot of small indigenous species. Where the exotic species, which have been specifically selected for to compete under conditions of higher fertility, the male outcompete species, whether they're exotic or introduced, that have been adapted
to tolerate conditions of low fertility. And the prime example is COVID. Except health. I think we will do a June for lunch at this point. This page, and we'll reconvene soon. And give us a chance to think about it. With the patients that we're asking. Okay? June until 2 o'clock.